Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 6th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Nurturing the Moral and Spiritual Lives of Children, Reading and Discussing the Bible and Practicing Family Rituals and Traditions. It is presented by Marsha Bungie. The number is BUM2002-07. Let's listen in.
Children and parenting for a lot of reasons. One, we have a couple children of our own, one and a half. And I also teach at a church-related college, and so we are always talking about issues of not only the intellectual formation of the students in our classes, but also their moral and spiritual formation. And so we have a lot of conversations about that. I also, you know, see a lot of my students come in and talk about their upbringing, talk about their questions and concerns. So that's another reason. And then maybe like many of you, I'm concerned about children in our midst, about some of the challenges they face and what the challenges that parents are facing today. We went through some of those challenges yesterday, and we can bring that up too a little bit later. But I think we all know there are a lot of challenges for children, for families. And so I'm interested in what we can all do, whether we have children or not, to help nurture the moral and spiritual lives of children in our midst. So that's the session's theme this week. And some of the general questions I want to be addressing across the week are simply things like, what are some of your own concerns about children and families today? What are some of the best ways you found to help nurture the moral and spiritual lives of children in your midst? What are some of the obstacles we have in our families, in our religious communities, in our culture, and in our country to attending to the needs of children and helping them mature morally and spiritually? We kind of went through a number of these obstacles yesterday for parents and for religious communities too, even though a lot of churches, we all say, of course we care about children, we care about families. Sometimes the church doesn't do enough to help support parents, I think, and help support children. So what are some of the obstacles in families, the religious community, and culture in our country? And how can we all work together more diligently to protect and nurture children in our midst? So what I had hoped to do this week is basically talk about 8 suggestions for doing that have been very, highly emphasized in the Christian tradition, but also are emphasized by some psychologists and sociologists today who are looking at issues of families and children. So I did a project last year with a bunch of contributors. We just looked back at the history of Christianity and said, what in the world have we said about children and our obligations to them? Not just parents, but the church, the community, the state. And it was just a real interesting project. We looked way back in the early church up to the 20th century, just looking at selected figures and movements. And sometimes you think it's all a terrible history, you know, that we've just seen children as, you know, sort of vipers, as Jonathan Edwards said, and you really beat the hell out of them as what you're supposed to do. And there are chapters like that. But there's also a lot of wisdom in there, too, about how do you nurture children in your midst. So I kind of pulled things out of that in a more thematic way, and then have been reading a lot of literature about families and children. And I found, I want to be talking this week about 8 concrete ways found in the tradition for helping to shape the moral and spiritual lives of children. This is primarily in the home, but also by the parents, but also by outside the home, by people who care about children. Because as we all know, of course, parents are the primary moral and spiritual agents of the child's formation. They're the ones who see them every day. But all children need mentors, people who love and care about them outside the family, whether that's relatives or people in the church, people in your community. So these are things you could do in the home, but also if you care about children in another context. If you get the white handout, that's really the only one that's the most meaningful today, this little white handout. Did almost everybody get that?
Not back here.
It's the white handout. Okay, and if we don't have enough, maybe some people will share. I think we have just enough. You'll see these kind of 8 things I'm going through. Number session 1, that was yesterday, talking about good examples, family service projects, why they're so important. Today is about reading and discussing the Bible and interpretations of it, and carrying out family rituals and traditions of worship, prayer, and service. Also, family rituals connected to community rituals. I think that's very important. We'll be focusing on that today. And then the other ones are 5, training children in music. There's a lot said in the tradition about how important music is and why it's so fundamental if you're talking about a child's formation. So it's real interesting what they say about music. Appreciating the natural world and cultivating a reverence for creation is another theme we find that's really important for a child's moral and spiritual formation. And then 7, educating children, helping discern their vocations. And 8, learning from children. So those are the kinds of things I want to go through, and then the last day spend talking about what the church in general could do more to help support parents in their task of nurturing the moral and spiritual lives of children. And as we go through what we're talking about today, we can focus on the broader issues also, but mainly focus on what do we think about this reading the Bible, and how do you do it? Can you do it creatively? Should it be done? I put a few questions down here, and these are the ones I'm most interested in, but maybe you have some others. That's under session 2. So we might like just take a moment to look at those questions. Why have theologians emphasized reading the Bible with children is an essential part of their moral and spiritual formation? And would you agree or disagree? Has the reading of the Bible been important in your own spiritual formation? And if we said, well, okay, it's important, what are some of the obstacles to reading the Bible with children? What are some helpful attitudes and approaches and practices for reading the Bible? There's a guy I'm going to talk about briefly, Paul Griffiths, who's made a distinction between what is religious reading and what is consumerist reading. And I think it's kind of a neat distinction he makes. So I want to spend just a little time talking about that. And he says, as he doesn't talk about parents and children, but I took from the book, he's talking about just the, what does it mean to read a text religiously? Religious reading. It's different than reading newspapers, magazines, and that we need to cultivate that. And I think we need to cultivate that with reading the Bible with children, too. So I'll talk a little bit about that. Should children memorize parts of the Bible? Interesting question. I'd like to just hear what you think about that. And then about rituals. There's so many interesting books right now by psychologists and family therapists about the power of rituals and traditions for building a family sense of connection, meaning, and identity, a sense of community. So I wanted to say a couple words about a couple of the books I read I found so fascinating about why these rituals are so important for families and that how they create connection and meaning in a family. And what are some family traditions or rituals emphasizing the Christian tradition that we could carry on today? What are some of the rituals and traditions that have positively influenced you and children in your midst? And then what are some of the obstacles to carrying out meaningful family and community rituals together? That's a question I'd like to hear your thoughts about. And is attending weekly church services important to a child's moral and spiritual formation? That's kind of an interesting question, too. Some people say, you know, we do need to do more in the home. So then if you do more in the home, what's the use of going to a church service, especially if kids are bored to tears and don't want to go, and you have to kind of fight it every week. So that's the kind of questions I'd like to explore together. And I thought what I'd do is, first of all, just give a few of my own thoughts about a few of these questions, and you can feel free to jump in at any time, add what your thoughts are, and we'll have plenty of time, though, for discussion. Mm-hmm.
Is it too much to kind of get a flavor of who's all here, where we come from, and I mean, not just the geography, but just our own, I assume we're all Lutherans, I don't know, maybe there's a mixed interfaith,
kind of understand. Well, kind of the religious background? Yeah, who is that? Maybe we could just raise our hand, who comes from a Lutheran tradition? Whoa, many people. What are some other religious traditions?
Catholic.
Episcopalian.
Presbyterian.
Baptist. Okay.
And I'm curious if there are any interfaith households here. I am.
Yeah, or even, we got the level, interdenominational. Are there a few families that way? Because that's an interesting thing, too, how when rituals are important to one family's tradition, And then you bring in rituals from another time. How do you weave those together? Maybe we could just talk too, very briefly, and then I'll go ahead, but some of the questions you have, if I haven't mentioned them here, specifically about our topic today, that we should hold up as we think together about some of the things I'm going to say and then what we discuss together.
What if only half of the marriage has any spiritual interest at all?
Yeah. Okay, so the commitment of, yeah, both the parents.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other concerns or questions you have?
I guess I'm a grandparent, and so if your children are not too interested in taking their children to church, that's another special set.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of part of the extended family. How do you navigate that?
Mm-hmm. And then, since we're all family, the four of us here, we have Mormons in our family, and that has been a real family situation because we enjoy being together several times during the year. So we have to always think how to handle different situations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because religion is important to us, and it seems like every time we get together, we discuss religion, our children, or you know, that sort of family tradition thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another issue about the extended family and how you work out, because rituals, you know, are important in your immediate nuclear family, but these extended family rituals are very important to young people, or the extended religious traditions and rituals in a community. And so how do you negotiate that? Any other kind of questions just as to lift up before I start talking a little more? Well, let me just say a few things about some thoughts from the tradition about why reading the Bible is so important, how you might approach it. And I'm just very anxious to hear people say, well, that doesn't work. Or, you know, hey, this is, we tried this. I want to hear very much, is that a meaningful thing to do with young people? Or have we got so many questions and or conflicts about the Bible ourselves sometimes that we don't want to do that? So I want to say a few words about that and then about rituals. But again, feel free to jump in any time. I do want to say that reading the Bible with children has always been emphasized as a very important part of a child's moral and spiritual formation. If you go back, like even to Chrysostom, he's a 4th century theologian who's very important to Eastern Orthodox Christians today. He talks about parents have got to read the Bible with their children, and he even talked about how do you do that. And he talked about, like, well, we got to compare texts. That helps young people to compare texts. And he even suggested you got to have, you know, what's appropriate, age-appropriate types of things you read from the Bible. And he suggested that little kids are too tender to discuss certain types of stories, and that you don't even discuss the subject of hell, he said, until they're 15 years or older. So this is a guy in the 4th century who said, hey, you got to do this, but there's ways to approach it, and that was kind of his idea. Or Luther and Calvin, all the reformers during the Reformation, had a very strong emphasis on you've got to read the Bible in the home, the parents and the children. It's got to be a daily activity. And they, you know, Luther even wrote the Catechism as a way for parents mainly, parents in the home to be teaching their children about the faith. And when we're talking about the Bible and reading the Bible, we're also talking about reading interpretations of it, whether that's little devotionals that might have a biblical passage and a small reflection on that, or various theologians who have reflected on Christian faith and life. So that's kind of the broader sense of reading the Bible together. So it has always been a very important theme in the tradition. And that's because, of course, the Christian tradition sees the Bible as the primary authoritative text in its tradition. So that the Bible is considered a sacred text that reveals truths about God and how people are to live out their lives in relation to God, in relation to other people, and in relationship to the natural world. Now, certainly Christians have very different views today about what is the exact nature of the Bible? What is its authority? And some people talking about the authority is, you know, the literal word of God, and every word is absolutely literal, has to be taken literally. Other people saying, no, we have to look at it historically. Not every word is literally true. But nevertheless, whether we look at this huge range of thoughts about the nature and authority of the Bible, almost all Christians say, you know, the Bible has some authority. It's a normative text. It gives us some guidelines how to live our life, how to think about God, about our relationships, and about the natural world. So that's why it's important, most people in the tradition say, too, that for adults, but also for children, to be reading the Bible. Now, because the Bible is considered an authoritative text, and again, your notion of authority might differ, but an authoritative text that reveals truths about God and humanity, the purpose of reading the Bible and discussing with children differs from the purpose of reading other books. You know, it's very good to read books with children. We all know that. Even doctors now are supposed to prescribe, you know, 20 minutes a day with very tiny infants. You've got to have them start chewing the books and, you know, opening those big hard cardboard books, and we say reading's great because it entertains them, it certainly helps them read, it educates them about a particular subject, it also helps you feel very close to the parents holding a child and reading the book together. There's a lot of beautiful kind of intimacy reading a book together. So there's lots of benefits and wonderful purposes for reading together with children. But when we talk about reading the Bible, people would add the central purpose of reading the Bible is more deeply rooted in the central purpose of parenting, and that is to help children grow in the faith, to help them love and serve the neighbor, and especially those in need, to reach out to the poor and marginalized. So that's a kind of deeper spiritual purpose related to the purpose of parenting, that you're helping these children grow in faith and to help them foster a way of life that loves and serves others.
We've had a couple situations come up recently that bring to mind not only age appropriate, but theologically appropriate.
Yeah. And
we took our youth group to work with a vacation Bible school, and the week we were there was creation week.
Mm-hmm.
And the former pastor of the church, who was still involved in the church, was concerned about how the creation story was going to be presented to children. And I had never thought that that would be a matter of concern, simply because I thought that kids from 4 years to fifth grade would look at it pretty literally and not too introspectively, and we wouldn't have to worry about whether a day was 24 hours long or not.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a concern about that. The other way it came up is in preparing for our own vacation Bible school, we had a whole set of these hero stories, which I think are great for little kids, including David and Goliath and such. One of the stories was Abraham and Isaac and mm-hmm. the sacrificing of Isaac. And I asked the teachers to really give some serious thought to whether they thought that was an appropriate story for
mm-hmm.
five-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And if they really felt they needed to do that, how exactly do you approach a father murdering his son?
Mm-hmm.
And so they decided, well, gee, there are a lot of good Bible history stories. Maybe we won't do that one.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have any thoughts or guidelines for age-appropriate?
Yeah, age-appropriate, and I like what you say, kind of theologically appropriate, too. I'm going to see if this helps, but and if it doesn't, we'll keep talking about it. But one thing that I think is often very harmful with young people is we even had this in high school with poems. If someone teaching a poem would say, what is the meaning? What is the meaning? Can you raise your hand? What's the meaning? No, that's not the meaning. Okay, what's the meaning? So it's like you have this rich, deep poem, and we got one little meaning out of it, and we're going to reduce it to that one little sentence that, you know, Jill got over here. So that's kind of what happens with these biblical texts, too. What's the meaning with the 24-day hours?
That's the meaning. Did you get the meaning? Okay. And then it's like, no wonder we don't read the Bible anymore. Because, hey, if it's that easy, why don't we just have like a few sentences, you know, 24 hours, and that's about it. You know, we don't see it as a rich kind of limitless resource. And I think that's a problem. And one thing I have like is this, so I'll say something and see if it helps, but that this Paul Griffiths, he's a teacher of really the philosophy of religion. And he's talked about, he regrets in our time we don't have these practices of religious reading. That we have what he calls consumerist reading. We read something once, we get the information and throw it out. We got what we needed. That was it. We read the newspaper, we read the magazine, we got it out. And so we tend to treat the Bible like that too. He's talking about all religious texts, meaningful to Islam, Judaism. But I think in the Christian tradition, we sometimes treat it that way too. Okay, we read it, we got the meaning, let's go on. And he said what we need to cultivate is get back to a kind of religious reading. And what does he mean by that? And I wrote down five of the things he means. And he's talking again about sacred texts in general. But I thought I'd just mention a few of these as kind of guidelines, just what you're asking about. What are some things to maybe keep in mind that might make it a more meaningful experience reading the Bible with children? And one of the first things he says is that you need to approach the text with reverence, wonder, and delight. That you're supposed to anticipate that you're going to gain something worthwhile. And again, we do have different perspectives on the Bible. Some very historical, some very literal. But even an historical examination of the text where some people say these are not authoritative anymore, these parts of the text. Nevertheless, I think we still believe very strongly there's something meaningful there. It's a very rich resource. And that we need to approach it with some wonder and some delight and anticipate that we're going to gain something, that the text really has something to offer us. That's an attitude we would foster with children. A second thing is see reading the text as a moral and spiritual responsibility. That this reading of the text isn't just entertainment, it's not just a good night story, it's something that's shaping the faith and character of yourself and of the children with whom you're reading the text. And so if you have that kind of attitude, you know, you would read the text often and you would see it as kind of having this deeper spiritual moral purpose than simply we're going to read it and have a nice little good night story. Religious readers, he says, read the text slowly. They reread it. They come back to it again and again, because if you see it as something that has something to offer you, you're going to go back to it again and again and reread it, just like one of your favorite novels. You don't mind reading it because you see something else, or your favorite movie. You go back. You want to see it again because you get something more out of it.
Just to point out that you're kind of a different person every time you read it.
Pardon me?
So you have all these, you know, different experiences, yeah. Different place in life. So every time you read it, it's a different person reading the same thing.
And children change. I mean, developmentally, they're going to start reading it, to seeing it.
Yeah, right.
That's just a natural. That's just going to be a natural process as well.
Yeah.
Developmentally, you change.
Right. That's a very good point. You're new. You've got new experiences and new thoughts, new questions every time you read it.
They can be presented in a different way. I mean, for instance, hand puppets.
Yeah.
They're really fun in the kids' circles. Acting stories out.
Yeah.
It's
not that. So the questions, the experiences we bring to the text every time we read it, it's going to open it up in a different way. This goes back to what you were talking about. You need to see the interpretation of the text as a continuous process. That the text is a limitless resource and its meaning really can't be exhausted. And there's some beautiful passages that this Griffiths has in his book on religious reading where he talks about the metaphors used to talk about sacred texts, that they're like mines or like oceans. They're like treasure chests. You keep going through them. You never get to the end of them. He says here, there can, according to all these metaphors of, you know, the gold that's in the mine, the treasure house, an ocean, a mine, according to all these metaphors, there can be no final act of reading. in which everything is uncovered. You know, there cannot be that final act in which the mine of gold has yielded all of its treasure, or the fish pool has been emptied of all of the fish. Reading, for religious readers, ends only with death, and perhaps not then. It is a continuous, ever-repeated process. So I think that's an important attitude to keep in mind, too, with children and young people. He talks about how important it is if you really see the text as, you know, this kind of treasure trove, that it would be important to memorize passages from the text.
Why is that?
And he talks about, and I think we have, you know, that's what I want to hear, what people think about. What about memorization? Because a lot of people had terrible experiences with memorization. And it sounds like, hey, it doesn't give us the rich, nice, you know, kind of idea about the Bible we have here. You memorize it, did you get it down? But he talks about memorization is a sign that readers have incorporated and internalized this text that's supposed to have meaning. They have ingested it, and it's now the basis for both contemplation and action. As Griffith says, a memorized work, like a lover, a friend, a spouse, a child, has entered into the fabric of its possessor's intellectual and emotional life in a way that makes a deep claim on that person's life, claims that can only be ignored with effort and deliberation. So it's kind of a way of internalizing the text. You know, I've struggled with the idea of memorization, but one thing that sort of helped me think about this was, you see how much kids are memorizing. They are memorizing Toy Story songs. They are memorizing Bambi. I mean, whatever things they've looked at again and again. And those are, it's almost like you talk about a tape in your mind, or one idea used is to talk about a memorial library. We all have a kind of memorial library, kind of tapes in our mind. And if you think children are, they've got those tapes in there. There's some tape spinning around in there. So do you want that tape to be all Toy Story or MTV or certain, you know, songs that they keep listening to again and again? Or do you want to put some other things in there too that are kind of at their disposal? And people talk about how meaningful some of this memorization can be to people even later in life who have Alzheimer's. Have you heard some of those stories where, you know, like, hey, they're just, you know, out of it, totally out of it. Nobody can't even recognize their, you know, son or daughter. And then you start singing a hymn.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, we're going to get into this. Yeah, or part of the liturgy. Yeah, the Lord's Prayer. So in that sense, that's, I've become more convinced somewhat about this memorization.
Well, and another thing that I got out of the Bible study is when Jesus was tempted in the desert, he had memorized, he quoted Bible verse to the devil when he was tempted. And so if we have Bible verses or verses in our head, we can also do that to the devil when he's tempting us, or mm-hmm. you know, just remembering those things.
Mm-hmm.
Times of grief, yeah. Times of terror.
Yeah.
And those times of concern, times of pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was basically going to say the same thing, because even, I don't recall, I know I memorized things as a child, and I don't recall that being a great advantage to me as a child,
yeah.
It may have been.
Yeah.
But it's certainly, and I haven't memorized nearly as much as I feel I would like to, but have had that be a great help to me as an adult. Mm-hmm. At times when I can't think of anything else, or when I, you know, it is times of great sorrow, or, you know, where it's just, that's what is the one thing that can bring comfort to me. And actively fighting against, you know, at times I feel like Satan's really trying to get to me, that's something that I can bring to mind. If it's not in my mind, how could I draw on it?
Mm-hmm.
Look through the Bible, look at my concordance, you know, it's
yeah.
like, I don't want to have to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think Lutherans can't flinch at the idea of memorization if they're old enough to remember
yes.
that we're going to learn the whole catechism by memory, and then we're going to stand up in front of the church
yes.
and the minister is
yeah.
going to ask
yeah.
us, and we
yeah.
better know it. We're
right.
forward or
yes.
boy, are we in trouble.
Yeah.
yeah I
so,
wonder, did anybody know get confirmed?
Well, what are some ways that you could approach it in a positive way? A memorization. Because I think people have those terrorized stories. And you know, they don't want to do that to their kids. They don't want it.
Go ahead. You.
Yeah.
We have a program within our Sunday school. It's called Peter Pebbles. And coming from Minnesota, we collect rocks from the North Shore, which are nice and flat and about this big around. And we have a group of women. We have a list of memorization. About 25 years ago, we decided that the children had lost the memorization skills, didn't know Ten Commandments by memory, you know, anything like this. So they came up with this program, and what they do is they paint through a process, but they paint the rocks, and then they paint little characters on them. I mean, and it can be Daffy Duck, or it can be, you know what I mean, they're cute little, like, cartoony-type characters. And then we have a woman that for 25 years has sat and has matched a Bible verse to whatever that character is. She has got, she's just absolutely fantastic. They put a seal on, and then for the little tiny ones, it's God is love, you know, for the three-year-olds or whatever. And for the four-year-olds, it's a table prayer. And, you know, and it goes on and on and on, up through the memorization of the communion service. And then from March, from January, for the Christmas, right between Christmas and Easter, Lent, and so forth, the concentration in the Sunday school is the learning for the people, the Peter Pebbles. And then we make a list of it and so forth. And the kids get to come in then after they've said their memorization, and they go to the office and they get to pick out whatever Peter Pebble is there. And those Peter Pebbles go away to college. They go into marriages, and they, my grandkids, they are in rows on top of their dressers. And they're wonderful, and we have recaptured the memorization art.
Well, that's a very creative way.
Yeah.
A lot different than, ooh. bad.
Well, and another thing that I heard years ago from a theologian doing a seminar, and he said that in his growing years, he had memorized and was doing well in school, and he was memorizing the Bible. And, you know, chapter, and then he, right, and he kind of lost it, he kind of quit doing it, and his grades went down, and he was having a terrible time succeeding at school, and he went back, something started him, I don't remember now what it was, but he went back to memorizing again, and it put his mind in such a trained mode that again he was able to succeed with his schoolwork because of the training of the mind with memorization. We don't really have it in the schools. We don't.
Yeah, they're starting to regenerate that in the schools a bit more because they realize we lost sort of that art, and it is important.
This gentleman over there, he was saying about memorizing catechism. I went to parochial school every morning, and we also have a learned that catechism. And when we were confirmed, we're supposed to know all the catechism, the creed, and the Lord's Prayer. And the articles and everything. And lots of Bible passages are also in there that we hadn't pulled. And it was a very memorable, and it helps you a lot as you get older.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You don't ever forget that.
Mm-hmm. But they change it a little bit here and there.
So you're saying it wrong now in church because it's not quite the same.
So you're kind of saying even if it was a little grueling, in the end, you see some benefit too.
Right. Oh, it's
of
wonderful.
It.
Wonderful.
I was raised Catholic, so I feel a little outnumbered here. I thought it was a little piece of hell to memorize all that stuff, and I didn't appreciate it at all. Actually, it made me very angry.
Yeah.
And when I got older. And so now I'm Episcopalian, and a secret about Episcopalians is they don't read the Bible.
They have ritual. They like
they have lots of stories based on the Bible. But generally, there's not a, and it's certainly emphasized in our services. And we spend time before, but it's not a huge thing, but the storytelling is important, and it is very age-appropriate. And I know that that's the one thing I don't want to happen to my children, is I don't want them to be so angry about what was down their throat.
Yeah, yeah.
So memorization, to me, is just that it really brings up some negative connotations.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were saying, because I have a distinct memory of having to memorize the passage. I can still remember it, but it wasn't necessarily because it's integrated. It was because of the experience. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is we don't force our children to memorize Toy Story. They do because that's what they're exposed to in great numbers. So it's about the absorption in terms of making sure that you're exposing them in some level of dosage to contradict those other messages that they get. So that it just becomes a natural part of
their fabric.
Yeah, that's
like
a good
Toy Story became a natural part of
right, you're not sitting there,
fabric.
Come
we
on.
We didn't make them memorize it, they just did. Because
we
both saw it. The issue of, I think a lot of, if you read the Bible directly and not as younger interpretation, it's very hard for them to understand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard for me to understand.
Yeah.
I've been in seminary, so I, tried. So what we've done is try to integrate places that gives them some understanding of God so that when they are older and can read and can start to integrate, that desire is there. So, for example, we certainly watch Toy Story, but the only music we play in the house on our little cassettes is generally VeggieTales or something Christian
mm-hmm.
that they love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but it's, in terms of reading
right.
directly from the Bible at 7 and 3 and a half, I find it very difficult because they glaze over.
Mm-hmm.
We have a small children's Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, the children's Bible is fairly interpreted. It's very,
there's a lot of moralism to it.
Yeah. Right, yeah. right. And almost makes the meaning seem like, hey, I went through that in first grade. I don't need to read the Bible anymore because it's so thin. The text itself is so thin.
It's one
I like what you're saying. Pardon me?
Because it's like one layer is translated.
Yes, and that's it. And so then you think, well, I got it. I don't need to read it anymore. I think what you said, too, about a lot of people don't want to start reading the Bible with their children because they say, I don't know enough about it myself. Or it's so weird, like too many weird passages. I don't know where to start. A lot of people do start, like you were saying, start with places you feel comfortable. Start with places where you say, boy, this text is meaningful to me. It's always been meaningful, whether it's, Corinthians or whatever part, some part of Luke, that you love that part of the Bible. And so you can start with that. You can kind of get that as a solid basis. Even Luther talked about, there's sort of a, he called, almost talked about like a canon within a canon. There are, if we talk about the Bible as a canon, and then there's certain texts that are more important. I mean, he said James was a book of straw. I mean, didn't mean too much. But there's some that are kind of at the core of who we are, and you can start there, and then you feel a little more comfortable, I think. What were you going to say?
I was going to say that a guy named Jerome Berryman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Familiar with
him? Yes, I do.
Godly Play. Yeah. It's I had an opportunity to hear him speak this last January and kind of demonstrate how he uses these stories, the mythic stories of Scripture, mythic in the best sense of the word, in the traditional sense of the archetypal stories about what it means to be human and what it means to be in relationship to God, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And he's developed a whole way of sharing those stories with young children
mm-hmm.
and telling and using, for lack of a better term, iconographic type of pictures on little Masonite boards about this size and telling these stories. So not looking at the book of Scripture in literal reading, but taking in the story himself so he knows the essence of the story, then retelling the story using these iconographic pictures
mm-hmm.
and spinning it out and putting it down in a visual way
mm-hmm.
and then inviting the children to wonder about the relationship of this particular picture to that one over there and as a whole and how one story might be overlaid against another story from the Scriptures and seeing how those stories might connect.
Mm-hmm.
Just inviting kids to wonder about it. So you're,
mm-hmm.
you're promoting a sense of openness, that there's multiple mm-hmm. possibilities for meaning and that it's a distilled essence of the story is what, you're kind of passing
mm-hmm.
the distilled aspects
mm-hmm.
of that on. And he has a website,
GodlyPlay.com. I put it, I have that little green sheet you can pick up at the end if you want. It has some theological things, some religious education type of thing, some psychological things I had mentioned here. So, but that Godly Play, I think you're exactly right. It's very good. It goes along with kind of what you were saying. There's a tangible thing about it too. It's got the pictures or the pebbles. And the other thing, and I meant to mention this, on the little sheet I gave you, I think it's important what Godly Play does too is keep in mind children have questions too. Children have insights into the text. And sometimes children open something up to us with their questions. So on that white sheet, I have just at the top, the kind of keep in mind at the very top, it says keep in mind that sometimes we have a narrow view of children as, hey, we're going to teach you this and, you know, get it down. When they are children, we see them, I think, way too narrowly. And what I love about some of these religious education materials, like the Godly Play, is there's a kind of respect for children. You see them as gifts of God's sources. And the Gospels are so great. We spent a little time on that last week, talking about children as models of faith, as vehicles of revelation. That doesn't mean they're more closer to God, but they have, there's a way they open something up true to us, or as seeing them as fully human, not just kind of on their way to being human, and we are going to teach you everything. They are made in the image of God. So I like to keep in mind, as we think about how do we approach moral spiritual formation, to have a richer view of what is a child, not just a kind of pre-human, you know what I mean? Or a commodity, or a consumer, or an economic burden. I think that's the way we look at children a lot of times too. But in this kind of rich way that I outline is sort of the beginning, sources of joy, gifts of God, made in the image of God, needing instruction, sinful, have moral capacities, but also vehicles of revelation and models for for adults at times.
Mm-hmm. I just had another question on the religious reading.
Yeah.
For my own education, I lead the J2A, Journey to Adulthood program.
Oh, yeah.
For our church. And it's new. And Journey to Adulthood is for children who are 13 to 18. Actually, 14
oh, yeah.
to 18.
Yeah, that's supposed to be good.
It's a very intensive program with the curriculum is flexible, but, you know. And you end that for in the second year, you take a pilgrimage to wherever the kids decide to go. But I had an idea, and I guess I'm just curious what other people think of it. I think there is value in reading the Bible. It says here consumerist, but I actually, the most powerful class I ever took was the Bible is literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of want to take these kids and say, throw out everything, just put aside the things that you've learned in church and in home, and let's get it on the table. Let's read it as the most interesting piece of literature you'll ever read, and then step mm-hmm. back from that and see where the meaning can be drawn. But it's really been a sort of discouraging to read the story, to get the whole story. Mm-hmm. Because we tend to, in studying scripture, hone in
yeah.
here or there. We never see
right.
the whole story.
Yeah. I think that's what's nice about, I think that's a good point. And part of that saying it's literature opens up a sense of wonder sometimes. Because you kind of, oh, I don't know. I got to look at this again. I don't know. So that's a very good point. But there's sometimes, I was going to say, looking back at historical context, sometimes getting the bigger picture, like that Man and Mercy book, you know, it's great. It is good because you kind of get a bigger picture. It's presented in a very accessible way. And then you're not just sort of focusing on this or that, but you have a broader picture. Not everybody's going to be, you know, the great biblical historian. And sometimes that's, you know, we get in our mind, oh, you must be this biblical expert. To be reading the Bible, talking about the historical context. But gosh, there's a lot of, you know, nice accessible tools, I think, even the backs of the Bible, that just give you kind of a general background, give you a general background to the history, and I think that's very helpful. There's some of these Bibles, like the New Revised Standard Oxford Annotated, is so great. I mean, it has the footnotes that are tremendous, and our son, he's, you know, he just turned 9. Like, sometimes we were reading about, you know, Moses and how, you know, God was going to kill Moses. And you go, what is that? And we're reading that. And he goes, what is that saying? And we looked in the footnote and it says, they don't know what it means. You know, people struggle with this. So it's kind of neat, too. He saw, hey, you know, there's some funny passages here. It keeps you alert. And I think applying the text to today. Maybe I should say just a couple words about rituals. So we get to that. And then we, because, gosh, we're zooming along here with the time. But, so I won't spend a lot of time. I'm just going to spend about 5 minutes. Then we'll have enough time to talk about what rituals are important to you. Maybe some more questions about the Bible. I think a fourth way of nurturing the moral and spiritual lives of children is certainly through these rituals and traditions of worship, prayer, love, and service. They're traditions and practices that communicate aspects of faith and are carried out on a regular basis. That can be weekly. It can be monthly, it can be annually, it can be connected to the church year and seasons of, you know, the church. In some ways, rituals are like routines because they're predictable, they're repeated again and again. But unlike routines, rituals have a deep symbolic meaning. They convey something about our values. And family rituals can take on a lot of forms, and maybe I won't give you some suggestions. We can get some up here, but again, it can be daily, weekly, tied to the church year. It can be as simple as saying a prayer before a meal. We were so shocked. We just adopted this little girl from China. She's already 17 months old when we got her, and we always hold hands and we say a prayer. And, you know, another language, another culture, all kinds of different food, been in an orphanage. So we pulled the hands and say, let's say a prayer. So we pulled the hands. And we did that, I am telling you, literally just twice. And then one time we were sort of still getting ready to put stuff down. And we had all just sat down, and she puts her hands out. And she does that every meal. Aren't we going to do the prayer? She can't even talk. You know, she can say hi, bye, that's about it. But that's something, the power of ritual already. She got it. That's meaning. And there's so many wonderful books now. I've got them on my handout there. But I'm just going to mention a couple. One is by Gottman. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Washington, Seattle. You know, he does the one on marriages and relationships. And he talks about sharing rituals build a strong sense of shared meaning and stronger bonds. Whether you're talking about relations with your kids, relations in your family, even in the workplace, he has this one book on, you know, how do you work with people, kind of repairing relationships. And he's talking about, too, even in the workplace, rituals help create a sense of shared meaning and help connect people together. They're a powerful force in building deeper connections and relationships for several reasons.
Which book is this version?
This is the one, didn't I have it on there?
On the Dream of Child in Our Hands?
Is no, the Gottman. Should Gottman. Be under.
The Gottman, John Gottman.
The Doherty book is the other one.
The Intentional Family.
The Doherty. Oh, maybe I did put Gottman on here. He's very popular. Gottman. Gottman. Just put it on there. I'm sorry I didn't get that on there. I thought I did. But he has several books. And the latest one, I think, is something like Building Connections or something. It's the most recent one where he talks a lot about rituals. And he says, just let me read a couple things he says here. I think it's so interesting. Rituals are a powerful force for many reasons. They symbolize cultural identity and values we share with families, friends, work groups, or a larger community. Even though people might say they believe the same things. Yeah, we agree, we believe the same thing. Rituals give you a way to put your shared beliefs into actions. Rituals also ensure people take time for emotional connection. Because they're repeated, they're predictable, they're easy to execute. We had such a fun time last week talking about how do you talk with your kids? How do you just sit down and talk? And a lot of times, you know, you don't want to say, okay, honey, now we're going to have a meaningful talk. Let's sit down. I don't want to do it, Mom. You know. But if you have this ritual, hey, we have breakfast every other Saturday. Isaac and I, we're going out, we're having breakfast. You know, maybe you won't talk about something really deep, but you've got this ritual. You don't have to say, come on, how are we going to get out your planner? Let's both find a time. You have a ritual. Or even, I know he's talking a lot about marriage, Gottman, but he said just even if you have like the, you know, 5 minutes after supper just to connect, say, how are you doing? But you have a ritual, so you're not constantly negotiating. And that takes so much energy, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. To say, when are we going to get together? When are we going to do this? Yeah. If you have the dinner together, that's so important. People talk about that as such a lost ritual, just having a family dinner together. A lot of families don't eat together, and there's just horrible statistics you read about. Even when they do, they're, you know, 70% are watching TV, or and many of them don't have even 4 shared meals a week. So that's something, a powerful ritual, eating together and you talking about the day. You can add another meaningful ritual to the dinner. Let's say you sit down to dinner. You could add another little ritual, like one family does this kind of appreciation ritual where you say, hey, I appreciated what you did about, you know, cleaning up the dishes today. And everybody shares one thing they appreciated about one another. And that's a nice way. Or the highs and lows kind of ritual. What happened in your day that was high? What was a low? So that's, I love the way he talks about it. They're easy to execute. Further, some rituals help us process our feelings as we move through life's transitions. Whether it's a transition of saying goodnight or getting married, rituals give us a way to adjust to transitions to express our feelings. And finally, rituals can help us stay connected despite our conflicts. Let's say you have an argument with a spouse or a child. The simple ritual, as the little goodnight gifts, the ritual of the kiss on departure, some way might be able to then help start repair the relationship again. So there's so many rich ways of talking about this ritual. And Dorothy, I did put him on there, this Dorothy, the intentional family. He's not necessarily talking about, the Christian family, but all kinds of family rituals, the yearly vacation. And he talks to, I won't say more about it, but how they really deepen a family's sense of identity because you're doing something together, a shared activity. It builds connection, it builds emotional connection, it builds a sense of shared identity. They act like glue, he says, that hold a family together because they're predictable, they create connection, they help create identity, and they're a way to enact your values. So that's why he thinks they're very important. I love what Dorothy says in that book about rituals. He talks about a couple obstacles. I'd like to hear what obstacles you have in your families or in your communities to carrying out rituals. And both these guys and others who talk about rituals are saying family rituals are important, but certainly also community rituals. The extended family rituals are very important for young people because you kind of see then that what you're talking about that is meaningful in your own home is also reinforced somewhere else, and it's got a wider kind of meaning so that young people see it's not just my kooky parents who think that, it's got this broader meaning. But he talks about two big, big obstacles for family rituals are, of course, the time bind, the demands outside the home. A lot of people, we talked about this yesterday, have a terrible money bind to the working poor, have a tremendous time bind and a money bind. So how you even get together physically to do something together is a problem. He also talks about, and I think this is important too, the technology is an obstacle inside the home. Mm-hmm. Technology, the TV, the computer games, the video games, the phone, and that we spend, the statistics are 22 to 27 hours of television. Children under 18 are watching. That's a tremendous amount of time. And that's kind of just going on in your home. It's an obstacle. So taming the use of technology, even a little bit, or sharing the technology together, like watching a show together, can be something then that becomes a meaningful ritual. They're watching their show, but you're doing it with them. You have time to talk about it afterwards. Anyway, paying attention to that can help, he thought.
David Walsh, president of the Media and Family Institute is based in Minneapolis. He's done a lot of research on the neural development of children and how screen time, whether it's computer games or television time, can adversely affect the basic neural development that goes on because our brains are very plastic those first 7 years. They're becoming... they're being hardwired. And he's done, they have some wonderful resource kits for families around how to shape how media, how technology is used within the home. So I really highly recommend that at the Media and Family Institute.
Media and Family Institute.
.org.
I haven't heard of that. That's great.
Yeah, David Walsh. And they've got some great kits, some, resource materials. And videos, things like that, that help educate parents. His goal is to help parents become educated so that they can, make decisions within the home so that they're being intentional rather than just allowing things to happen in a way that can be detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really good.
That's good. Well, the rituals, we might just add one last about the, what do people think about the ritual, connecting your family rituals to larger community rituals like the weekly service. People talk about, even if that's hard on kids, there's real tremendous meaning to that because even if you just talk sociologically, why is it good to take kids to, a worship service, a community worship service? There's a lot of just sociological benefits. Other people like your kids, care about your kids maybe, that's good. You need more than just your parents thinking you're an interesting, lovable kid. You also talk about how you see other people's concerns and problems. It helps children develop a kind of sense of whoa, what are the problems out there? How might I help? You can maybe do service projects through that community. That's very powerful for young people. We talked about that last time. These service projects done with caring adults is very powerful. So there's a lot of benefits, even if you just talk sociologically. You don't even care about, you know, necessarily any spiritual religious issues, but certainly connecting, seeing other people, sharing those rituals with them. I think the communion ritual is so powerful because we're coming together, these different people, different, you know, there's so few occasions we come together with people from different economic backgrounds, different academic backgrounds, but they come together at the communion table, and so that's a powerful thing as well. So what are some other maybe obstacles or traditions you found very helpful in your experience?
I guess an obstacle is just how do I apply it to me? Because when rituals and traditions are done in groups with groups of people, how can I practice that on my own when I'm alone or when I'm not with the same people I normally do the ritual with, or and still have meaning for, you know, the text of the Bible?
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like everything is done in communities, especially the Christian community, the churches. Other religions do it more in the family, more at, you know, outside of a larger community.
Mm-hmm.
And just taking it down to the individual level, how do you help that? I guess there's an obstacle to, you know, learning on your own and having that relationship with God on your own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a very interesting point, that balance of the individual, the community. A lot of times I hear friends who are so tired of the church, they can't handle it anymore. The sermons are so bad. They can't go there. So then they think, but there's something missing there then too. You can read these wonderful books. You can read spiritual resources at home. But you're missing that community element of sharing some of those values. But you can flip it the other way, too much community. I have a lot of students, I'm always so shocked, 95% of my students, I'm at a church-related college, are Christian, Catholic, Lutheran, Methodist, Presbyterian primarily. They would say they're confessing Christians. And you know what they say? It's so interesting. They've been to Sunday school every week, they've gone to services with their parents, but they didn't come home and talk about those things. They didn't have the rituals at home. And so they don't even know what their parents are thinking. And now, some of them, you know, had a very rich home life and talked about it, but I had that one statistic yesterday where only 10% of, they did a very big study, 8,000 adolescents, only 10% of their families, from very active people in congregations, 10% of the adolescents spoke with any regularity with their parents about issues of faith, and only 43% spoke at all, sort of rarely, but spoke sometimes. So there's a kind of gap there on the other side, where, hey, we're doing all this thing with community, but I guess religion's so private, you don't even share it with your family. So that's a problem, too.
Uh-huh. So we always talk about, you know, if we're in the church, or we always kind of want to call it debriefing or whatever afterwards. And I think that's really helped a lot, because it makes the kids feel like they have an important say, and it develops a sense of observation and, you know, meaning for them in terms of being able to evaluate, you know, for example, like, why is it that, you know, certain churches, they have this shellacked bread out there, you know, and I guess it's decoration for some people. For others, they break their bread every Sunday, and that's important. You know, why in some places do only these people wear the robes and others they don't? And it's like, you know, just talking about these issues just develops a real spiritual and theological person.
Mm-hmm. That's very, very good. Talking about it afterwards is very helpful in reviewing.
Uh-huh. I grew up in a home where we went to church every Sunday, and then when I went off to college, my parents stopped going.
Mm-hmm.
And it shocked me. I mean, it was just like, well, I thought we went because this was important to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really got a good answer from my folks about why they stopped going, but I was left with this, well, they were doing it to give me some kind of moral and spiritual. I mean, they didn't tell me that, but that was my presumption. So I think it would be good, you know, now my thing is, well, to do what you're talking about, to incorporate it more, so it is more than just the act of going, of doing
mm-hmm.
it every Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Some way carrying it into the home. and people talk to him. What if he had the best church service in the world, the best curriculum, the best religious, but you didn't do anything at home? That one little hour compared to the 27 hours of TV, that's not going to do that much. You know, it's got to be the everydayness. Yeah, Barb?
Well, I just wanted to put in a plug for Holden in a way. I think for some families, mm-hmm. when I read evaluations, this place is a sort of bridge between the institutional church and those boring Sunday services and home. Parents will say that their kids like to go to worship here and they can take stuff from here home, like the Holden Vespers. Or interestingly, a number of families say they take the hunger awareness meal home, the Thursday lunch where we just eat potatoes or rice and remember the hungry people. And I remember when we were really scared to do that during the summer at Holden, we thought it would alienate guests and stuff. But some families mm-hmm. write on their evaluations that this is something they've done now at home, and it's a really nice connection with Holden, and it helps educate kids about hunger, and it's a ritual.
Yeah.
But it builds connection.
Mm-hmm. Or they were talking about that giving bowl, uh-huh. you know, in the sermon mm-hmm. a couple days ago, about that empty bowl and putting money in it. Kind of that, it's neat when you have not just, hey, our family's creating this, but we're part of a bigger mm-hmm. community here that finds this also important, this ritual of the meal or that giving bowl.
Mm-hmm. This is going to respond to what I think I heard is the question. I'm not sure if I heard it right, but we do tend to compartmentalize. Church is here, mm-hmm. home is here, and even if we're deeply religious as adults, it's a spatial issue. And I have the added issue is that my spouse is an atheist completely and doesn't share in any of our spiritual, but I find it important to share my own spiritual values with my kids. So we create a sacred space in our house, and you know, it's a mirror of the community, it's a mirror of the altar, but it's there, and it's there for anybody, and I don't need to sit with my daughter and be there, because I found her that she's 7, I found her there by herself sometimes. But because we've created a like space and we don't mm-hmm. separate out church from home, and you know, even though we have a lot of nice art, we also have religious art mm-hmm. too. Because I guess that I've learned as I've gotten older is I need to be reminded mm-hmm. daily. When I walk mm-hmm. to a church, I'm totally reminded. I'm overwhelmed. I feel yeah. religious, and then I go home and I see, you know, art that I like that has nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. So kind of yeah. very specifically throughout our house, I have things placed at eye level for kids. Mm-hmm. So they get something out of it, and it's mm-hmm. a sacred space. And we eventually figure out our husband.
Yeah. That's a neat point. You know, this Bushnell and Isis, he talks about how religion never penetrates life until it becomes domestic. Mm-hmm. That it's That's the true. Everydayness that brings it about. And kind of incorporating that in, that's a very good way of doing it. Visually, with spatially, with the food, the rituals around the meals, those are all ways to do it.
Yeah, and I was thinking as we were all talking about, you know, several of us memorize a lot. One of the things we memorize is the commandments. Mm-hmm. And one of the commandments is remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy.
Yes.
And it doesn't, I've learned now that it doesn't mean walking into a building, but that's part of it, whether it's a building, whether it's outside, mm-hmm. whether it's a picture, you know, however you interpret keeping it holy.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point, too. A lot of people are starting to really build on this idea of the Sabbath, keep it holy. And Dorothy Dash, she has a nice book in there, Receiving the Gift of Time. She's coming in this week, Dorothy Bass. And she's written a lot on the Sabbath. And a lot of people are building on it. You know, like, we do the weekly service thing. But then we're not going to buy anything, for example, on Sundays. We're not going to consume. We're not going to go shopping. Oh, that Godwin book.
Ours didn't used to be open.
Right.
I mean, I'm old enough that I remember now. Now we have 24-hour days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, DeGraff book, you know, the affluenza. He had that hardly statistic. 95% of teenage girls, their favorite activity is shopping. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, you know, 95%, that's something. So anyway, they use it, they keep building things on it. Not that you start out, okay, 24 hours, the Sabbath, we're gonna do it all different. But they just chip away at it. Hey, Sunday we go to church, we have this meal afterwards. We're not gonna do the shopping, or maybe we're not gonna watch television. We're gonna do some family activity. Anyway, that's kind of a neat way to, how do you keep the Sabbath holy? Yeah.
I'm really intrigued with that idea of developing a sacred space in the home. Mm-hmm. I was reading a book about controversy in the mainline churches in the early 20th century, and one of the persons was talking about the home altar, and I had no idea what they were talking about.
You know, there's first of all, we, as Christians, we really need to look to other faiths and other traditions. I mean, if you look to, I live in India, and everyone had an altar. In our house, it's really important. My children have a lot of friends from a lot of different cultures, so ours, we have a big cross up there. We have things that remind us. We have stones or we have candles, so that anybody who walks in our home and sees the altar would feel comfortable with that. We also have a lot of Christian decor too, and during the seasons we change it. So during Christmas, it's obvious that we're celebrating Christmas, but we don't put it in the, it's not in the middle of the living room, because that's a space to entertain whoever comes. But we have it pretty prominently in our library, and we go in there and it's a quiet space. My kids know that that's not a place, that's the one room where you don't yell. Even though it has multiple functions, we read in there, we do other things. But it's just space. And we do treat it that way.
That's neat, the space and the time. Think about ways of space and time.
I think there are two places that we need to look to with the things that we're talking about. One is the Catholic family. So many of them have the Virgin Mary. Now that maybe would not be our choice, and we don't want to pray to the Virgin Mary or whatever, but Catholics do have them. They've got grottos in their backyards, they've got their statue in their home, whatever. And the traditions of the Jewish faith, their Sabbath, I mean, there is nothing as traditional, really, as that the Jewish Sabbath.
And it's in the home. It's in the home. We've lost that, where we've got to have the rituals in the home, sacred ritual. Well, gosh, thank you for all your money. Thank you. We had a good discussion. I don't think we got to the extended family. Yeah.